out among the outlaws, he said, "Come, follow me." People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.
Welcome to Becoming Outlaws podcast, which engages celebrities, scholars, and diverse voices in candid conversations about following Jesus, defying societal norms, and exploring profound questions of faith. The son of Sam, whose real name is David Berkowitz, is a notorious American serial killer who terrorized New York City during the summer of 1977. Berkowitz claimed to have been commanded by a demon who communicated with him through his neighbor's dog, and he went on a shooting spree, targeting young couples parked in cars. His killing spree resulted in the deaths of six people and the wounding of several others. Berkowitz's capture in August of 77 brought an end to this reign of terror, and he was subsequently convicted of multiple murders, leading to his imprisonment, and I believe it was about 300 years sentence. The Son of Sam case remains one of the most infamous and chilling chapters in the history of American serial killers. Several serial killers, including David Berkowitz, have claimed to become born-again Christians while in prison. Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee Cannibal, Ted Bundy, Dennis Rader, also known as the BTK Killer, or Bind, Torture, and Kill, and others. Are these jailhouse conversions real? Is evil real? Or are those who can commit senseless, horrific violence simply psychopaths? When there are claims of demonic influence and hearing voices, if real, are they psychological only, or are they diabolical? Or can they be both? A new book has been released entitled Monster Mirror. The author, Dr. Michael Caparelli, spent 100 hours with David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, in prison interviews. Michael was a pastor for 16 years and understands the spiritual side. He also has a PhD in advanced studies of human behavior, so he understands the human psyche. And that combination gives an intriguing and holistic view of human behavior, especially when the behavior could only be described as evil. We're fortunate to have Dr. Capelli on today, and welcome Dr. Caparelli.
Thank you for having me on, Ken. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So, Son of Sam, what led you to David Berkowitz?
Well, you know, I had written a few prior books on mental health from a faith-based perspective. Back in 2021, I mailed David a copy of Dr. Jesus, which was one of my prior books on mental health. I mailed it to him just with a compassion for those in prison. I grew up in a home where my dad was in prison. My mother used to take me to see him. Euphemisms in Italian-American families is dad is in school. I said, where is he? I was about 10 years old, and she said, well, he's in school. I said, what's he majoring in? She said, law.
Yeah.
Funny thing is, my dad's about, I don't know, close to 70 now. Here I am, my mid-40s, and he still references the days when he went to law school. I'm like, Dad, you didn't go to law school. We're beyond this at this point. All that to say, I had a compassion for inmates because of my experiences with my dad at a young age. I also was incarcerated at 17. I was a very troubled adolescent. So with that compassion, I mailed David a copy of the book. He read it within, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. I'd received back from him a letter and a request to meet him for a visit at Shawgunk Correctional Facility in Wallkill, New York, which is about 2 hours and 30 minutes from where I live. And I drove up, met with him, and he said to me during that first visit, number one in 34 visits, 100 hours. He said, you're the guy I've been waiting for to tell my story. You have both an understanding of the supernatural, having been a pastor for 16 years, and evidently by your book, Dr. Jesus, and your education, you also have a nuanced understanding of the human psyche. So therein, in that first session, it began a case study, the longest analysis ever conducted on David Berkowitz. Back in the 80s, a criminologist by the name of Dr. David Abrahamson had sat with David for about 50 hours. He wrote a book in 1983 called The Confessions of Son of Sam. And I doubled the time. And of course, my perspective wasn't merely Freudian, but it was also scriptural. So yeah, it began, I want to say, early 2022. And it carried me all the way through the summer of 2023. And the book was released in October of this year.
Yeah. So skeptics, which I think we all should be, on jailhouse conversions. What are the typical reasons that happens when they're not real? And how often are they real? And how do you know they're real? How do you know David Berkowitz is real?
Great question. I mean, listen, David Berkowitz is not the first serial killer that I've ministered to. There were two others. I don't want to say their names, but they were both psychopathic, coming under the guise of religion, pretending to be Christians, at least one of them. And it took about, I don't know, maybe 6 months to a year for me to figure this out. And we reached an impasse in the relationship. It was just too many games. David Berkowitz.
What's the end point for them doing that? Are they wanting you to write off that they're, for parole purposes, that they're reformed?
Yeah, one of them, it was that, for that reason. The other one was actually looking for money. At some point, he wanted me to write a check over to his sister, who is obviously in free society, to continue this case study, expecting me to write a book and make some profit on it. He said, you know, since that's the case, I'd like you to send so much money, gave me a dollar amount to my sister, and it just ended the relationship.
Yeah.
With David Berkowitz, you know, you say jailhouse conversion, there are many of them. They don't last 35 years.
Right.
David Berkowitz gave his life to Christ in 1988. And to the extent of his involvement in his faith, I mean, he disciples 16 guys. He meets with these guys every Wednesday night. He's been doing this for decades. He's involved in the Sunday church service. They call him pastor. So he's under constant watch and scrutiny to see if he really is the real deal. You know, we think jailhouse conversions, but those are typically, you know, experiences that are not steady, but they're spurty. And they're typically to make an appeal to a parole board. Now, David does meet before a parole committee every 2 years. He's meeting before the parole board in June of 2024. But most of his parole hearings, he hasn't even showed up. He only shows up now because it was perceived as arrogance that he blew off these parole committees. So now he shows up, no expectations of leaving, simply to share his testimony. How do I know he's the real deal in addition to all that? You sit with somebody for 100 hours. Not only are you observing actions, people say actions is the best indication of someone's character, certainly not speech. Talk is cheap. Right. But I would argue that even actions are not the best litmus test. People can put on a good act. I mean, Shakespeare said the world is a stage. All of the people are its thespians. The real indication of someone's character change is not actions, but reactions. Actions under pressure, actions caught off guard, taken by surprise. The Bible says to taste the fruit, and by the fruit you'll know the tree. Well, fruit is the offspring of the tree's root systems, and it's usually through pressure that fruit vegetates or manifests. And I seen David. I seen what comes out of him under pressure. In fact, in one of the chapters I describe, I talk about a moment when he was angry. I showed up at a particular session. He had a conflict with another inmate. The inmate said something degrading. And when David showed up at the session, he was upset. I mean, beyond upset. I knew he was angry because typically when he walks into the room, he greets other inmates. He's very fatherly, very pastoral. This time it was a quick courtesy smile. Typically he settles into the chair. This time he was sitting at the edge of the chair. I said, David, why are you angry? What's bothering you? And for 3 hours, I watched a man get angry, but sin not. So I've had many moments I describe in my book, Monster Mirror, where I got to see not just David's actions, but I got to see his reactions. I tasted the fruit, and the fruit speaks of salvation.
Yeah. You know, when I think of just the Christian life in general. And, you know, I grew up in church, so I kind of don't even know how many sermons besides reading the New Testament myself. But, you know, Jesus forgives all sins, and he'd even forgive Hitler's sins, and just on and on. And we kind of get that as a notion. But then when you, like, when the rubber meets the road, and I think, you know, I believe that. But if I think if somebody randomly, for no reason or any reason, killed my child, and I heard they had a turnaround in prison, I think to be part of me, like, I know that's good and that a person's eternal soul matters. There'd be a part that I would agree with mentally, but there'd be a part where, honestly, I think I'd be like Jonah, where I don't want that person to receive the gospel because I know God is merciful. You know, that town at Nineveh or whatever, he didn't want to go there because they committed such atrocities that he didn't want them forgiven. Mm. Do you know how the families have handled this or at all?
Yeah, you know, to speak to the first thing you said, Clive Staples Lewis said it best, C.S. Lewis. He said, everybody thinks forgiveness is a lovely idea until it's actually time to forgive.
That's right.
We talk about forgiveness, but you're right. When the rubber meets the road, and the rubber did meet the road for Nasa Moskowitz. Nasa Moskowitz was probably David Berkowitz's greatest hater. David Berkowitz's last victim, Stacy Moskowitz, I want to say she was 20 or 21 years old, inside of a parked car in Bath Beach, Brooklyn, in August of 1977, David Berkowitz emerged from the shadows, and he unloaded a .44 caliber bulldog into her brain. And in fact, that night when she was going out on a date, Nasa said to her, "Stacy, please be careful. There's a lunatic. He's roaming the streets. He's already gunned down 10. Be careful." And she said, "Mom, you have nothing to worry about. He's not targeting blondes." And she was actually the first blonde victim and his last victim. And Nasa was a hater, rightfully so. She couldn't stand David Berkowitz. If you go back and YouTube some of the earlier interviews with her on Geraldo Rivera back in the 1980s, outside the courtroom of his sentencing in the late 70s, she calls him a dog. She says that she wishes he'll rot in hell. But then in about 2000, she forgives David Berkowitz. I mean, God does something miraculous in this old Jewish woman's heart. She's living in Florida, and she writes David a letter, and they begin a friendship. They talk on the phone regularly. In fact, David gives me access to all the letters. They're actually behind me on the shelves. All the letters that were exchanged between him and Nasa, they became very close friends. They were actually going to work together on a book or some kind of project about forgiveness, but Nasa, unfortunately, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and she died about 20 years ago. So looking at Nasa Moskowitz and seeing the radical forgiveness of God, it puts, you know, me, an outsider, in a position where if Nasa can forgive David,
yeah,
how much more should I be open to hearing his story?
Right. The other things that comes to mind when I was thinking about this topic and the situation is, you know, it almost seems unforgivable from a human perspective. But then Jesus says, you know, all those you didn't visit in prison, you didn't visit me.
Hmm.
And those you did visit in prison, you did visit me. Well, who's in prison? Thieves, rapists, murderers. I mean, there's troubled youth like you were, but it doesn't say just troubled youth. It just says prison.
Absolutely.
And that takes it to, that doesn't exclude David Berkowitz or Ted Bundy's or, you know, you got to,
you know, there's tough, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it's a tough faith. I mean, it sounds great, but to live the kindness, it's really divine. Is it may be evil to do those acts. It's almost just as divine to engage that evil.
You know, historically, every society has had its groups of people that were considered irredeemable. In the Bible days, the tax collectors would certainly fit the bill. The tax collectors were, you know, swindlers. The tax collectors got what it takes to take what you got. I mean, they were just a lot of people's financial setbacks were because of the dastardly practices of the tax collectors. So when Jesus tells the parable of the Pharisee going into the temple along with the tax collector, and the Pharisee says, "I'm not like them people." Every society has had them people. I mean, you bring it to the early 1900s America before AA and NA. If you were a quote unquote junkie, you were considered irredeemable. Now that has changed. You know, we've seen drug addicts go to Teen Challenge and other programs and be transformed. Every society has had those people. Well, in today's day and age, those categories with cancel culture, of course, are growing more and more. But psychopaths are definitely the tax collectors of 2023. The data shows they make little headway in therapy, that they don't make much progress. Cancel culture certainly says they should rot in hell and die. Hollywood movies presents them as sort of mythologized, almost like devils in human form that have no hope for redemption. So for me, one of the passions of telling this story is, yes, David Berkowitz in 1977, he lights up the psychopathy scoreboard. Any characteristics on the dark triad that deals with psychopathy, from Machiavellianism to narcissism, all these traits, low empathy, inability to regulate impulses, David fit the bill. He was undoubtedly, in his own words, at that time, a psychopath. So to see him transformed in 2023 is a true miracle. And it was one of the great passions of telling this story. Personally, I can't stand cancel culture. I want to meet these perfect people that engineered this. I really want to know who they are, because to write off someone and say they're beyond redemption is to really play the part of God. And I think that David Berkowitz is living proof that even a psychopath, whosoever call upon the name of the Lord, shall be saved.
Yeah. Well, let's take that into, I think it's a not far of a leap to talk about your, so you just did the mental scope, psychopath. When does psychopath cross a diabolical area? So in his specific case, he claimed a demon was talking to him through a dog, and then through courts, he took it back, and then he, I think, claims it again. But he was involved in satanic rituals or the occult world back then, wasn't he? So there was an element of demonic. He didn't just pull that out of a hat after being arrested.
That's correct. I mean, look, here's the deal. When we're trying to explain a guy like David Berkowitz, probably the easy trap to fall into is something known as causal reductionism. It's to reduce a complicated phenomenon to one simple answer because our minds want simplicity. So when people ask me, was it psychological? Was it diabolical? Was it sociological? My answer is it's all of the above. And that's part of my task in this book, is to shed light on, yes, there were sociological forces at play within a cult that he was involved in. There was also lots of psychological factors. And yes, we have an enemy that preys on the weak, preys on those that are vulnerable. So yes, David Berkowitz would tell you he was mentally ill. There were mental health factors that are described in the book. But at the same time, a dark presence that he says began at 6, 7 years old, he's a little boy, and he's hiding in dark closets for hours. It's a sunny day in New York City, Saturday afternoon. Mom thinks he's playing stickball with his friends on a Saturday afternoon, and he's hiding under the bed for 3, 4 hours because he can't get enough of the darkness. Urges to jump in front of subway trains in the Bronx, the Soundview section of the Bronx, when him and his mom and his dad would train to Manhattan. So David says, Mike, there was a dark presence from the time I was a young kid. And I believe the enemy is predatory. He preys upon the vulnerable. And we describe in great detail some of the vulnerabilities, the risk factors, the mental health factors in the book Monster Mirror.
And why do you call it Monster Mirror?
So I meet with David and I'm expecting, you know, hearing David's story, because I want to find out not just David in the now, but David then. Tell me about the Son of Sam, the evolution of a baby into a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And I'm expecting and hearing that story that I'm going to look into the eyes of a monster. Instead, I find myself looking into a mirror and I find some very striking, uncanny parallels between David and myself. And I walk away from each session thinking, there but for the grace of God, so go I. Now, listen, we've got 13 mass shootings a week in the United States of America. That statistic is insane compared to other parts of the world. We got to ask ourselves, why is this happening? And every time it happens, parents will say, I would have never thought my son, the criminal profile keeps expanding. I mean, at one point, you know, the profile was pretty simple. This is what to look for in people that commit these crimes. Take Columbine, for instance. You got two killers behind Columbine, Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold. Can't be any different in personality. So different in even their mental health diagnosis, but yet committing the same crime. So I think we have to come back to the biblical perspective of people, is that anybody's capable of anything. I think that criminal psychology, I teach it in the college. You know, I teach psychology, abnormal psych. I teach in three different schools, a Christian school and two secular schools. My PhD is behavioral science, and part of that was criminal psychology. But I think that these labels, these diagnoses, we got to be careful, because the facts are any one of us can evolve into a psychopath. I think the better term is reprobate in Romans chapter 1. Reprobate to me would be the best parallel to psychopathy. It's a mindset that's distorted. Values are very low. The conscience has lost its ability to feel guilt and remorse. But the beauty of reprobate is the Bible's clear that anybody given the wrong set of choices and the suppression of truth can evolve into this. It's a warning for all. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. We, as a culture, just call that our dark side, right? Like, everyone knows there's kind of a dark side that most of us just have the background or the life or the manners or the social skills or the control to behave in a culture properly. And this isn't an excuse for Son of Sam's, but, you know, right? You tend to look at their history and maybe they didn't have those foundations we had, tons of weaknesses, which psychologically make them vulnerable to what we call a dark side. But the dark side, faith person or not, faith person, say there actually is a dark side and there is evil. And what you're saying, the weak are preyed on.
Most definitely. You know,
I want to hear yours on this, but I think about, and I was even asked to be off YouTube because I said this before, I'll say it again because it's scriptural, is we think in our minds like, well, you know, that's super evil and that's demonic, and or people who murder innocents, they should be in hell, even if we don't believe in hell, we just know that's a concept. But at the same time, like in Jesus' day, according to the Bible, the most holy men, quote, holy men of their day and the law keepers, Jesus said their father was the devil, that there's only a kingdom of light and darkness, and that we're all, if we don't think we're living in darkness, or involved, we don't have to be in satanic rituals, but in that same kingdom, it's only because we're deceived and just don't know we are.
You know, you raise a good point about the religious in Jesus's day. Let's keep this in perspective. It was the religious that crucified Christ, right, that committed the most horrific act against the most innocent person. Think about that. I mean, you don't get any more innocent than Christ, and you don't get any more horrific than the cross. So you have religious people committing the most horrific act upon the most innocent possible person. If that's not tantamount to what a serial killer is capable of, I don't know what is. So we kind of come up with these categories, you're right, and say, well, those serial killers is a little bit different. It's not, it's a different species. It's not quite like the evil that I commit. But I think the Bible is clear that the heart of man, not the heart of a psychopath, the heart of mankind is wicked and deceitful above all things. We'd like to think that there are other people, other kids would commit school shootings, not my kids. Other people would commit murder, not me. There are no other people. And that really is the reason for that second name or word in the title, Monster Mirror. The book is not just a picture of a monster, but it's also a mirror. The reader is going to meet David Berkowitz. And in meeting David Berkowitz, the reader is going to meet themselves.
So going in as a former seasoned pastor, a professional mental health person, after that experience and that extensive time, what did you learn? Did you come out thinking differently about human nature or see faith differently in any way?
Yeah, you know, I was just asked that question on another interview, and it really made me think for a minute. I'm glad that you're asking it now, and I've already thought it through. I had a period of burnout. I pastored for 16 years. A church full of people in recovery from addictions, releasees from prison, the mentally ill. And I got to a point where I just lost the confidence that people can change. I just saw too many people take two steps forward, three steps back. I was burnt out in pastoring. I suffered two heart attacks. I had a minor heart attack, and then I had a widowmaker while boxing in the gym. I had a gym partner call 911. And they put four stents in me, just completely burnt out from pastoral ministry. You know you're burnt out. Here's a sign that you're burnt out. And I'll get back to your question in a second. You know you're burnt out when you're sitting down and you're fantasizing about how relaxing jail would be. That's a time. Yeah. That's a good time you're burnt out. Good or a good indication. So I meet David Berkowitz, and I'm this burnt out pastor. And I sit with him for 34 sessions, and my confidence that people can change and the worst among us can transform. My confidence grew tremendously because David Berkowitz, I watched him regulate impulses, which they say psychopaths can't do. I watch him experience great remorse. I watch him exhibit empathy on so many different levels. And then to go back in time and to hear his story in 1977, to look at the pictures, to study 1,600 documents, court documents, arrest records, psychiatric reports, to look at who he was in 1977 all the way through the early 80s, contrast that with who he is in 2023, I walk away from this case study saying, God can do anything. And I'm glad I sat with this man because my faith in God's ability to transform people was renewed through this experience.
How do people come to faith in prison typically, or maybe him specifically? Is it because they have so much time? Is it prison ministries? Or is it just a chain of somebody found faith, so they share it and it just makes its way through the jail cells? And is there a big divide then? Is there just like these hardcore guys? I'm talking about the long-term life sentence guys. And then there's these Bible study guys. It doesn't seem like there could be much of an in-between in prison, but I don't know.
You have a lot of Muslims. In fact, Islam is probably the fastest growing religion in prison. Wow. Not Christianity. Well, Islam provides a certain sense of pride, aggressiveness, if you want to call it that. It's more Islam is more appealing to the personality types of those that are in the criminal population. For David Berkowitz, 1988, he's been incarcerated already for 11 years. First in Attica, then in Sullivan, and he's walking the prison yard. It's a winter evening, and he's by himself, and he's as bitter as it gets. I mean, he had pretty much in 1988 the typical inmate mindset, and I've dealt with inmates for a long time, that they are the victims, right? I've been cheated. My lawyer lied to me. The judge, the judge did me wrong. Society's got me wrong. I mean, just that whole twisted mindset. He's angry. He's bitter. and he's walking the prison yard. A guy named Rick, he's in his 20s, probably same age as David, maybe a little younger. He approaches David, and he's a Latino man. David hadn't really known him priorly, but he says to David, Jesus loves you. And David says, Jesus doesn't want anything to do with a guy like me. And Rick says, I disagree. And Rick meets him in that prison yard for a period of 6 months. I mean, he made David Berkowitz his personal project, his assignment from heaven. Well, after about 6 months, David receives a Bible from Rick, a little small pocket Gideon Bible, New Testament combined with the book of Psalms. David takes it back to his cell. Now, he had read the Bible during his military days in the 70s, but the experience he had with religion at that point was more superficial, we'll call it that. Now, here he is in the cell. He's reading the Bible at night. He doesn't want to read it during the day because he says it's not easy to be a Christian in prison. This idea that you become a Christian to have an easier experience, that's not correct thinking. No. So he waits till nighttime, kind of like Nicodemus coming to Jesus at night, turns on his lamp. The lamp shines on the Bible. He reads Psalm 34. This poor man cried out to the Lord, and the Lord delivered him from his troubles. He gets on his knees. He said, I spent about an hour sobbing just over my sin. He said, not my circumstances, not the wrongs that people did to me, but the wrongs I did to people. I wake up the next day and it felt like 1,000 pounds had come off my chest. I meet Rick in the prison yard that night. I tell him I gave my heart to Christ, and Rick starts rejoicing out loud, saying that there are angels celebrating right now. So that was David's story. It was a one-on-one in a prison yard, someone bold enough to share the faith, and then his own personal encounter in his cell with his Bible repenting of sin.
Yeah, well, what's your story? I mean, what I heard was troubled youth, incarcerated, and then 16 years as a pastor. There's a little something happened in there.
Same deal. I was in juvenile jail. I had a pastor in there who just passed away, by the way, died 3 months ago, named Mike Krautman. He was a clergyman who went into the juvenile detention center for 30 years. He worked as a correctional officer, but they also allowed him to conduct Bible studies. He was a guitarist, a musician. He would play songs that he wrote. They were usually kind of urban theme songs. And I remember feeling the presence of God. I remember him giving me a Bible and telling me that what I felt was the presence of God. My eyes filled up with tears. I didn't get saved in the juvenile detention center, but I felt the presence of God. Like I could feel him reaching out to me. It was right after my release, I met another believer, somebody that actually hired me at a company. I had to get a job per court order. And that believer took me to church. The church service reminded me of the church service in the juvenile detention center, gave my life to Christ at 18 and never turned back. Was in Bible school by the time I was maybe 20, 21, graduated Bible school, bachelor's, master's degree, Liberty University. And then during my pastoring, I spent about 8 years of that pastoring pursuing the PhD.
So to kind of bring this in, to kind of summarize here, I think, so your book is, like I said at the intro, it's really interesting. I think, of course, any crime junkie people are going to be interested. And as a matter of fact, you probably saw it. I don't know, but I just watched Netflix on Son of Sam. They did a pretty good job on that whole situation, but they're not going to talk about a spiritual side like your book would, or most books would. So to have a pastor and a mental health person writing has such a unique angle on it. What would you say, what I kind of see out of it in general, besides learning about him and his conversion and different things, is kind of hope for like our own kids that we think aren't redeemable or just aren't ever going to come to faith. Or, I mean, if we bring it down to our level, we may think, well, serial killers aren't in my scope of fear. Sphere of living on a day-to-day basis, but just people we work with or know, or they just say, well, they're never going to come to faith. Well, then you can read a book like this and realize anybody can come to faith.
You nailed it. I mean, I am a peddler of hope. And I'm hoping that the book accomplishes exactly what you articulated, that it gives a booster shot of hope to someone reading it, psychologically troubled, can't pull themselves out of the pit of depression, a parent who's got some strung out kids strung out on the streets, maybe someone that, like David, has homicidal urges. I'm so grateful that the book ranked number one new release on Amazon in October for 3 days in the serial killer category. I'd rather it be a number one in the serial killer category than in the religious books category, because people, it's a light in the dark place. It's grace in gritty places. And that's what I'm hoping is accomplished, is somebody is in a very difficult spot. There's no way out, and they read it. And let me tell you, here's the evidence of this, not just my book since its release, but David Berkowitz receives hundreds of letters a month for the last 35 years from the suicidal, from the homicidal. Why do they write him letters? Because they think, well, listen, he's not going to throw stones, not with his background. I can go to a guy like this. He's a Christian now. He's not going to judge me, because he's come from the worst possible place. Even the serial killer who committed 4 murders on a college campus a year and a half ago, the campus killer, I think it was in Utah or Idaho. Utah. Where was it?
Yeah, Utah. I think you're right. I think it's Utah.
Utah. The guy wrote David Berkowitz twice. Two times. So, you know, you got a whole world of people that are oppressed, that I think David's story is relatable. In a culture that's this twisted and sick, we need to hear stories of people that are twisted and sick being redeemed and coming to their senses.
Our culture is so bad that I don't know if the Son of Sam would have been a notorious serial killer now, because we're loaded with them, that we don't even know them by name. It's too much.
He was the first fruits, if you want to call it that, the first bad fruits of what we're seeing now is more prevalent, more ubiquitous than ever before. You're right. In 1977, for David to do what he did, I mean, for those of you that like true crime history, 1977, New York City was in a state of fear. Nobody had ever seen anything like this. The guy's taunting the media. He's leaving letters to the New York Police Department, to Captain Joseph Borelli. He's leaving the letters on the corpses of the people he's killing. The letters are printed in the New York Times, the Daily News. New York is in a state of hysteria because he was, at that time, an anomaly. Disco clubs were closing early. They were normally closing at 1 a.m. They were closing at 9 p.m. because a lot of his victims were shot at night. Women were cutting their hair short because a lot of his victims had long hair or dyeing their hair blonde. So we're talking hysteria because he was an anomaly. But today, that anomaly, Martin Scorsese said something interesting. He's a popular film director. He made a movie called Taxi Driver, which Taxi Driver played a great role in the Son of Sam killings, a big influence on David's psyche, because David's seen the movie. He identified with this outsider named Travis Bickle. And Travis Bickle, you know, the end of the movie, he shoots up a bunch of people in New York with a .44 caliber. It's the movie that inspired David to go out and buy a .44 caliber. And, you know, Martin Scorsese said just this summer, he said back in the 70s, he said Travis Bickle was an anomaly. He said now, and I don't know where he got this statistic from, if it was based on a survey or what, but he said now almost every other person is Travis Bickle. Almost every other person feels like an outsider, feels like they can't connect. They're on the fringes. They'll do anything to get attention. And I thought that was an interesting statement. It was right in the wake of the release of this book. And interestingly enough, as I said, Taxi Driver was one of the factors behind the scenes in the making of The Son of Sam.
Interesting. All right, Juan, thank you for your time. And thank you for what you're doing. You're doing a lot. You're out there speaking, writing books, college professor, keeping busy. All right. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Counted among the outlaws. laws. He said, come, follow me. People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.